Support for KBOO comes from our listeners. If you value independent media, go to kboo.fm and click donate. And thank you for supporting your community radio station.
Latin America's most renowned novelist now lives in the Bay Area in California. She's the author of some 20 books, including Maya's Notebook, House of the Spirits, Paola, Daughter of Fortune. Her latest book is called Ripper. She was born in Peru. Her family was in Chile, where she went back to. We will do the full interview with Isabel Allende about her work next week. But for now, this does it for Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Andres Thomas-Conteras, to Clara Ibarra, and as well to Robbie Caron. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Dina Guzman, Amy Littlefield, Cassandra Lazare, Messiah Rhodes, Tarina Nadura, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Stelly, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Vesta Godars, and our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug Meadows, Carla De Jesus, and Phil Raymond. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The time is 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland.
When our children are old, they'll know land can't be sold.
KBOO is a co-sponsor of Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence, this Sunday, April 20, all day at Portland State University. Part of PSU's Earth Week activities, the theme of the gathering is Resist, Restore, Reinhabit. The event is free and will feature a full slate of panels, including a history of the bioregional movement, emergency preparedness and community resilience, bioregional governance, biocentric resistance, and much more. For more about the event and a full schedule, go to cascadiaconfluence.org or go to their Facebook page. Again, that's Cascadia Rising this Sunday, April 20, beginning at 9:30 a.m. on the second floor of Portland State's Smith Memorial Union on Southwest Broadway in downtown Portland.
No tyranny, we'll make a true democracy. Soon one day Cascadia shall be free.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Auditor comes out with a new report on the Portland streetcar service.
The U.S. State Department delays its decision on the Keystone XL pipeline.
And an earthquake shakes Mexico City. This week, Portland City Auditor published a report questioning the management of the Portland streetcar. the streetcars operated by the City of Portland, TriMet, and Portland Streetcar Incorporated. The report focuses on the efficiency and transparency of this public-private partnership since the streetcar was established in 1995. It also raised the possibility that the city violated state law. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Drummond Kahn from the Portland City Auditor's Office. We'll get that.
Get the mic. We'll be back to that story in a moment. Next, Clackamas County today joined 8 other counties in Oregon that have stopped honoring requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. These requests attempt to detain foreign-born jail inmates over documentation issues after they have served their time for their original offense. Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts said his office has already released suspected undocumented immigrants from custody. The move follows U.S. District Court Judge Janice Stewart's ruling that Clackamas County violated a woman's Fourth Amendment rights by honoring a request by immigration officials to keep her in custody. The ruling inspired a number of jails and police departments across Oregon to reevaluate their compliance with ICE detainer requests. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office has itself lifted 50 holds since the ruling. Judge Stewart ruled that the county's practice of keeping Miranda Olivares in jail on behalf of ICE means that she was arrested a second time when her charges were already settled and there was no new warrant for her arrest.
The faculty union at Portland State University has ratified their proposed contract with the university by a rate of 97% following 2 days of in-person voting on campus. 2 separate contract-related celebrations were held on campus Wednesday. Student activist groups held a rally in the Portland Park Blocks at noon with food, music, and conversation about next steps. Wednesday evening, the faculty union, PSUAAUP, sponsored a reception at the Simon Benson House on campus. Both groups pointed to the contract settlement as a first step in changing the direction of the university from what they called a corporate model of higher education to a student-centered, community-focused model. On April 7th, PSU President Vim Wiewel addressed the Faculty Senate. At that meeting, he admitted that he hadn't understood the full extent of the faculty's frustration. The new 2-year contract raises the amount of multi-year contracts for non-tenure-track faculty from 45% to 80%, and it lowers the seniority required for such contracts from 6 years to 4. The contract also preserves existing promotion and tenure language in the contract and creates a task force to explore increasing academic quality.
If you log on to the website for General Mills, you might start to notice some changes. The terms and conditions of interacting with the Fortune 500 company changes users' ability to take legal action against them and limits recourse to arbitration. General Mills owns such subsidiary companies as Kellogg's, Yoplait, and Kraft Foods. For clarification on how these new rules affect the average patron, KBOO reporter Robin Ryan discussed the development and the dynamics with a member of the legal team at the watchdog group Public Citizen.
I'm talking with Scott Nelson. He is an attorney with Public Citizen, and I want to talk about some assertions being reported regarding General Mills. And how wide-sweeping are the assertions of the kind of legal language in these new terms by General Mills?
Well, it's pretty remarkable. What they're saying is that anybody who uses their website, downloads an online coupon from them, signs up to get emails from them, or joins what they call their online community, which is a term I'm not even sure what it means. But anybody who does that, they say, is entering into a contract with them that will require them to arbitrate any claim they subsequently have, as far as I can tell, at any time in their life. against General Mills, including claims that arise out of injuries they may suffer if they purchase one of General Mills' products from a grocery store.
If memory serves, the arbitration system in general has a tendency to favor bureaucracy.
Arbitration tends to favor companies in a number of ways. One of them is that this arbitration agreement prevents people from banding together in class actions. And a lot of consumer-type claims are really only financially viable if they can be brought as a class action, because sometimes when consumers are defrauded or they buy a product because of exaggerated claims that are made about it, that it's healthy or all natural or something like that, you know, each consumer is going to suffer only a small amount of harm, but together the company may be reaping millions of dollars of benefit from all those people. So a class action is a way of getting all those claims together so that the cost of pursuing them can justify the potential recovery.
Are you aware of any estimates of how many may have already unknowingly agreed to these terms and conditions?
No, I haven't seen anything about that. But, you know, one of the things that's covered is participating in their programs and promotions. And one of the ways this first came to my attention was people who participate in something called Box Tops for Education, where people, I think, collect General Mills box tops and send them to school with their kids, and then the schools get certain financial benefits depending on how many box tops they collect. Those people think that they're probably subject to these terms and conditions, and I imagine that there are tens of thousands of people participating in that program.
Great segue into my next question. How important would you say it is that such tactics need to be pushed back against, and how would you recommend people go about that?
Well, I think it's critical. You know, ultimately, we need to do some things at the legislative level, too. You know, the Federal Arbitration Act, which is what the Supreme Court has used to sort of push these agreements on all of us, you know, that needs to be changed. But there are some things. I wouldn't sign up for any emails from General Mills. And people who have signed up for it ought to say, I'm leaving your online community because I don't agree to these new terms. A coupon for 50 cents, that may be a thing that has some value to you, but if the cost of that is giving up your legal rights for the rest of your life to access our justice system, I don't think it's worth it. That's selling your birthright for a bowl of cereal, in biblical terms, you know, not a very good deal.
That was Scott Nelson, staff attorney at Public Citizen. For more information, you can visit their website at citizen.org. Reporting for KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
We now have that interview with Brian Katz speaking with Portland City Auditor about the management of the Portland streetcar.
So I was wondering if you could give me a little bit of background on sort of this audit. When was it first commissioned and sort of what was the idea behind it?
Yeah, we began this audit last year back in the middle of 2013 out of interest that the program had been around for about 19 years, had a lot of city funding, and our concern was around how much responsibility, both operational and financial, the city retained for a streetcar program that had outside partners, including Portland Streetcar Incorporated, including TriMet, to look at that issue and see if there were any risks that warranted auditing.
What were sort of the central findings of this report of the Portland streetcar?
What we found was that while the city applied a partnership approach that used city managers and staff, it hadn't really transferred risk or responsibility to those partners, which means the streetcar is essentially owned and operated by the city of Portland. That's okay, but the city is making all kinds of investments in the streetcar where we're just interested in making sure that partnership arrangement is clear, yet we found that the structure itself is both convoluted and confusing. That puts the city at some risks in that now the streetcar structure is not readily transparent to the public. We found that it doesn't reflect the actual level of city control to match its responsibilities. And we also found some concerns around related party relationships and some perceived conflicts of interest just in the way the streetcar organization is structured.
Can you go a little bit more in depth about that? What do you mean by that the structure is convoluted and confusing?
Well, it's not clear. In the report, we actually tried to distill the organizational structures for both the city oversight and the way Portland Streetcar Incorporated is working. We argue that it was confusing to us, and we think confusing to the public, to see where the responsibility rests, given that this is a public operation for the streetcar. One of the concerns is around the contract the city has with Portland Streetcar Incorporated, just in terms of whether the public interest is best protected, whether when things are procured or purchased, that's used competitively, as well as mechanisms the city might use to hold the contractor accountable. But it's renewed that contract for over the past 19 years, and we think that's complicated by the city lacking an overall mission, an overall strategic direction, and again, that very complex partnership structure all presented some concerns. This was not a clear, clean structure that made it easy to see what the goals were and how the city would know that it had reached those goals with the streetcar.
One of the main questions that a lot of critics have been focusing on was the finding that the city or Portland Streetcar Incorporated violated state law. Can you explain that a bit?
We don't say that there was an outright violation of state law. We're saying that there was some work that happened that may not be consistent with state law. This has to do with the sort of the legal notion of who possesses, in one case, the money that the streetcar collects. As you know, you can purchase tickets from streetcar vending machines. As we and the city controller and others see that issue, this is a city system, a city streetcar, the money belongs to the city. So the state rules say that the city should be collecting that money and depositing into a city account. What's happening, partly because the structure is blurry, what's happening is that Portland Streetcar Incorporated employees, we understand, are collecting the money and putting it into a streetcar account rather than city employees collecting the money and putting it into a city account. We think it ought to be clear to the public, you know, who's running the streetcar, whose money is funding the streetcar. Overlaid on that is the notion that more of the city's transportation revenue, what's called the discretionary transportation revenue, is going to fund streetcar operations at the expense of street maintenance.
Do you think that this lack of transparency is true for other public-private partnerships in Portland or public-private partnerships in general?
Not necessarily. I mean, the literature on public-private partnerships shows some pretty good success stories, and there are some cases where risk is transferred, where the city might be hiring a vendor to pave a road, or the state might be hiring a construction contractor to build a building. And it's not that the streetcar, you know, isn't efficient or doesn't run well. It's this notion of kind of who's in charge and how are we structured and what's the goal. In other words, it would help to know whether the streetcar was intended to be a transit system versus intended to be more for economic development. That would affect how often cars run, how you set fees, where you plot the routes that a streetcar would go.
What are some of the recommendations of the audit report going forward?
Well, the first most basic recommendation is that the city adopt a mission and strategic plan. We think that there could be much clearer contract agreements that transfer risk and really spell out which party is responsible for what within operating the streetcar system. Our final recommendation, and probably the strongest one, is that the city defer any expansion of the streetcar system until those other recommendations have been implemented.
I have been speaking with Drummond Kahn from the Portland City Auditor's Office. This is Ryan Katz with KBU News.
At the annual Food Safety Summit in Baltimore, Maryland, many of the attendees have reported being sickened with food poisoning. In attendance at the annual conference was the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, McDonald's, ConAgra, Monsanto, and a host of other large multinational food corporations. The Deputy Commissioner of Foods at the FDA, Michael Taylor, has been the focus of protests in recent weeks. Critics have labeled him as a perfect example of the dangers of the revolving door politician and corporate insider. Two of Taylor's first achievements were the approval of recombinant bovine somatotropin, or RBST, and GMOs food crops in U.S. markets. Injection of RBST in cattle increases milk production, but also produces more pus and bovine growth hormones in the milk, which has been linked to increased rates of cancer in humans. RBST is currently outlawed in Canada, Japan, Austria, and the entire European Union. RBST was approved by the U.S. government in 1993. In related food safety news, a Freedom of Information request has revealed a pattern of replacing career professional meat inspectors with low-wage temporary inspectors. This has worsened an already critical shortage of slaughterhouse and meatpacking inspectors. The Centers for Disease Control reports that in 2013, there were 76 million food-related illnesses in America and over 5,000 deaths.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will see showers with a high of 58. Sunday will be warmer with a high of 67. On April 18th in 1924, Simon & Schuster published the first crossword puzzle. Also on today's date in 1954, Gamal Abdel Nasser seized power in Egypt. And on the same day 1 year later, Albert Einstein passed away at the age of 76. The quote of the day comes from Mr. Einstein, who said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it."
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The wizard turns out to be a phony, just an old guy sitting behind a curtain, using his booming voice to spew nonsense in a vain effort to fool people. But now, a century after Baum's fictional Oz, a real-life incarnation of the phony wizard has been discovered, hiding behind not one, but two curtains. He's recently been booming out his nonsense in full-page newspaper ads that are hyperbolic screeds against economists who favor raising the minimum wage, denouncing them as radical researchers. The ad directs readers to a website named minimumwage.com, implying that it's the site of independent, unbiased, non-radical economists. But no, it's not a group at all, just a curtain. Who's behind it? Something that goes by the name of the Employment Policies Institute, which sounds rock solid, but it too is just a curtain. Go to 1090 Vermont Avenue in Washington, the address of this institute, and you won't find any economist or any other employee, for the Institute has none. But you will find the old wizard sitting there, manipulating statistics, twisting logic, and spewing out economic nonsense. The Wiz turns out to be nothing but a 71-year-old PR and advertising hatchet man named Richard Berman. Various corporations pay him to set up official-sounding front groups that advance their political agenda. The Employment Policy Institute, for example, is a front for the big restaurant chains. They want to keep profiting by paying poverty wages to their workers, so they've hired Berman to trash any and all who support raising America's wage floor. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Institute provides a varnish of academic legitimacy for unvarnished corporate greed. As the watchdog group PR Watch says of Berman's Flim Flam, they are little more than phony experts on retainer. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
During the past few decades, environmental activism has taken many forms. There is a growing movement called bioregionalism spreading around the Pacific Northwest. This Sunday, there will be a conference exploring the idea of bioregionalism. KBOO's Paul Rowland has more.
And I'm speaking with Ilona Trogub, who's with one of the organizers of the upcoming Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence coming up this Sunday at Portland State University. Ilona, could you tell us what is this why are you holding this conference? What are you trying to do?
What I've seen is that there's a growing group of people all around the bioregion of Cascadia that stretches from southern Alaska down to northern California out to the Continental Divide. And there's really some energy happening around organizing on a level of localism, and more specifically here in the Pacific Northwest on a regional level. And that looks like creating a new identity for people who want to really root down in place instead of, you know, having their identity based on political concepts or unrooted, disconnected from ecology, concepts disconnected from ecology, I guess, the best way to say it.
So I noticed the theme or subtitle of the conference is Resist, Restore, Reinhabit, which is kind of like a take on the reduce, reuse, recycle. Obviously, that was intentional.
Yeah, we're trying to get away from thinking just economically and consumptively to thinking about the ways in which we interact with each other and with the land. So through resistance work, we challenge the notion that growth is good. We reestablish healthy relationships with the land through restoration. And through reinhabitation, we take into consideration who we are here in this place.
Give us a taste of what people can expect if they go to this confluence, which I guess is a different way of saying conference or gathering.
The idea is that we're coming together through a confluence, and there's a confluence of ideas happening. There's a confluence of different perspectives and different places all throughout the bioregion coming together. And bioregionalism, which is sort of a really holistic approach to living in place, is going to be explored through a talk by Judy Goldhaft called The History of Bioregionalism. There's going to be panels about what it means to consider indigenous sovereignty in local governance, what it looks like to consider rights of nature in local governance. There's just a really wide berth of ideas and topics that are going to be explored at this confluence.
And so that's this Sunday, and where and like what time is it starting?
So it's starting at 9:30 a.m., and it's in the second floor of the Smith Memorial Student Union at Portland State. There's just amazing things all throughout the day, and then the day concludes with more sort of art and theater. And
so where can people go for more information about this?
CascadiaConfluence.org is our website, and on there you'll find a schedule along with really good descriptions of all the panels and workshops that are going to be happening. And it should be an amazing event. It seems like there's lots of excitement on the streets about it.
And I was speaking with Ilona Trogub, who is the one of the organizers of Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence, coming up this Sunday at Portland State University from 9:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. And with KBOO News, this is Paul Rowland.
The state of Washington rejected the U.S. Department of Energy's proposal to amend a federal court agreement governing cleanup of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. The March 31st proposal would stretch out the timetable for cleanup by eliminating many deadlines for key project milestones. Hanford for decades made plutonium for nuclear weapons. Now it's engaged in cleaning up the nation's largest volume of radioactive waste near Richland, Washington. The cleanup is governed by a federal court consent decree reached in 2010 that sets strict milestones for the cleanup process. But the Energy Department has said it's in danger of missing many of those milestones because of the complexity of the work. The consent decree set deadlines for emptying some of Hanford's underground waste tanks and starting to treat up to 56 million gallons of nuclear waste at the waste treatment plant. The Energy Department has said most of the remaining deadlines are at risk of being missed, including having the cleanup work completed by 2022.
The State Department said today it will delay a recommendation on a permit to allow construction of the Keystone XL pipeline pending settlement of legal challenges to the pipeline's route through Nebraska. This means that a final decision, which was expected in May, could now be pushed back until after the congressional midterm elections in November, removing a political hot potato as an election issue this year. As evidence of what a hot potato this is, environmental groups have persuaded 100,000 people to sign a pledge of resistance, promising to engage in civil disobedience if the State Department recommends approval of Keystone XL to the president. The 1,700-mile pipeline would move heavy tar sands crude oil from Alberta, Canada, to the Gulf Coast to be refined for eventual export. In February, a Nebraska district court blocked the governor's decision to allow the pipeline to pass through the state, putting the pipeline's route into question. The case has been appealed to the state Supreme Court, and a ruling there is unlikely to come before the end of the year. Environmentalists are opposed to the pipeline because mining the tar sands in Canada will add one-third to Canada's total annual emissions of greenhouse gases. It will also add to acid rain in the U.S. and devastate an area of boreal forest the size of Florida in Alberta, Canada.
A magnitude 7.2 earthquake shook central and southern Mexico today, sending panicked people into the streets. Some walls cracked and fell, but there were no reports of major damage or casualties. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake occurred at about 7:30 a.m. Pacific time. The quake struck 170 miles southwest of Mexico City. There, people fled high-rises and took to the streets, many still in their bathrobes and pajamas on the Good Friday holiday. Debris covered sidewalks around the city. Mexico City is vulnerable to even distant earthquakes because much of it sits atop loose soils that can amplify the seismic waves. Authorities have not ordered an evacuation, but some residents are leaving or taking other precautions in case of aftershocks.
An avalanche caused the deadliest accident to date on Mount Everest this morning, killing 12 guides and injuring 6 more. Another 3 to 4 people remain unaccounted for. At one of the world's most popular climbing sites, this time of year represents the beginning of the climbing season on Mount Everest. A group of about 50 people were hit by the high mountain avalanche at elevations greater than 20,000 feet. The incident surpasses the number of deaths in a single day when 8 climbers disappeared after a storm in May of 1996,